By the way, that thing about PGP, it's not the most widely used encryption software in the world. I would have to say that would be SSL, which Paul Kotcher was one of the principal inventors of, you know. But PGP is widely used in email encryption. So the problem is nobody encrypts their email. So it's not very widely used. Because of the difficulty of having people understand trust models and public key infrastructure and how you can certify public keys. So we don't have to rely on the NSA getting better and better at their job and breaking our crypto schemes, because mostly we don't use crypto. So the biggest obstacle probably to our electronic privacy is the fact that nobody uses crypto. Fortunately, it's starting to change in that more and more websites are forcing the use of SSL. So our links to websites are getting better that way. I think that everybody is more aware now that our electronic lives are more and more exposed, in part because of the revelations of Edward Snowden. And so everybody's trying to up their game. You know, the IETF is doing initiatives to try to deal with the problem of pervasive surveillance by looking at the existing standards and trying to make new standards to make them more widely deployed, to make them more ubiquitous. The industry is trying to create more products that can create more and more pervasive use of encryption. Trying to get away from the cognitive burden of learning how to use trust models, we have to find a way to do that. Web browsers that depend on public key infrastructure for SSL keys are finding ways to improve the vulnerabilities of public key infrastructure. Public key infrastructure has incredibly spectacular failures. Some years ago, I'm sure many of you have heard of that certificate authority's signing keys were stolen by an Iranian hacker who then used it to forge credentials for SSL X509 credentials that he then turned over to the Iranian regime, which then used it to conduct man-in-the-middle attacks on Iranian dissidents and then arrest them. One could not write a fictional novel with a more catastrophic, spectacular failure of public key infrastructure than that. So we have to find better ways to do it. Probably the best thing we have going right now in that respect is certificate transparency, where you use Merkle trees to try to have an auditable log of all the keys issued by a certificate authority, so that you can see if somebody stole the signing key of a certificate authority and issued bogus certificates. Web browsers can automatically check them to see if they really did come from the authorized certificate authority. The Chrome browser has this built in, and more websites are starting to use it. In fact, I thought we were at Silent Circle, but apparently we haven't implemented that yet. We better get moving on that. Something that I gave a talk just in the last hour in Amsterdam through a video connection. There was a conference there on the future of cryptography, and one of the central themes of that was what to do about quantum computing. Well, in my view, quantum computing is kind of like nuclear fusion. We've been 5 years away from a breakthrough in nuclear fusion for the past 50 years. So someday we'll have nuclear fusion, break-even nuclear fusion. I don't know when we're going to have practical quantum computing. But if we do get quantum computing, perhaps that will make nuclear fusion get closer to reality. So one of the things that we have to work on to prepare for that is, if we are going to prepare for that, is that we either have to use quantum key distribution, which is an interesting kind of science project, interesting physics, you know, sending photons one at a time through a glass fiber and figuring out distributing keys that way, that where the photons have not been intercepted because of quantum entanglement. But but I think that's a science project looking for a problem to solve. But the problem that it solves is the problem of what happens if quantum computing becomes a practical technology. And if it does, then you could use something like that. The problem with that, though, is that it only works through glass fibers or maybe satellite-to-satellite communication with lasers. And if you want to make products that work in the real world over Wi-Fi and 3G and LTE and other kinds of practical communications media, you can't use quantum key distribution. Something that I did some years ago in the protocol that I've been working on for the past decade is the ZRTP protocol used for secure VoIP. And it I put in some things in that kind of prepares for quantum computing. I didn't talk about it much because I didn't want people to think that I was a crank by giving too much credence to quantum computing. But since I just got out of a conference earlier this morning that kind of did make a big deal about quantum computing, I thought maybe I should mention something about how I did that. About a decade ago, when I was designing ZRTP, this is a protocol that's used for secure telephony, and we do an ephemeral Diffie-Hellman exchange. And for some audiences, I would have to explain what that is, but I have a feeling that this audience is well aware of what a ephemeral Diffie-Hellman exchange is. And then we destroy the keys at the end of the call, so we have perfect forward secrecy, and we avoid the use of a public key infrastructure by computing a hash of the session key and displaying a truncated hash that's used to verbally compare to see if the session keys match. And we have elements in the protocol that make it possible to truncate that down to just 16 bits and not give the attacker the ability to exhaust 16 bits because he only gets one guess. We do a hash commitment before the ephemeral Diffie-Hellman. But that still is not going to protect you from quantum computing. Sorry, I keep getting questions from people about quantum cryptography because they confuse it with quantum computing. The idea that worries people today is that even though there's no quantum computers today, Intel agencies could capture traffic and store that traffic for many decades, waiting for the opportunity to break the public key crypto that's used to protect that traffic, and thus break it in the future. I mean, you know, the NSA did this with Soviet traffic from World War II. The Venona project, they took many years to break it, taking advantage of the Soviets using one-time pads as two-time pads. And so, you know, it went on for many years. Intel agencies have a kind of long-term patience in that regard. So even though quantum computing is not a threat today, it is in the future, if it becomes available, then all of your message traffic today, if it's captured, or at least the interesting stuff is captured, it could be attacked in the future. So with the ZRTP protocol, what I do is I didn't want to use these exotic mathematical advanced public key schemes like lattices and coding techniques that involve keys with millions of bits. And they're thousands of times slower than current public key algorithms. I just needed to use the components that I had available to me, which is block ciphers, hash functions, and an elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. And so before destroying the keys at the end of the call, I take a hash of the session key and store it in a cache. And then the next time I call the same person, I do a fresh Diffie-Hellman exchange with random keys again. But before computing the new session key, I mix together the hash session information from the last call. It's a symmetric secret. It's not like key continuity that SSH uses, which is a caching public key. So by mixing in this cache material, I make it so that if the man in the middle was not present in the first session, he can't break any subsequent session, not even with quantum computers, because there may be operational obstacles to him capturing every single session. And with this protocol, it's not only that if he just misses the first session, but if you have a series of secure phone calls with people, and if your opponent misses even a single one of those phone calls, then new shared secret cache material is captured and stored and then used for key continuity in such a way that he's forever locked out, even with an infinite number of quantum computers. And so ZRTP is already pretty well, you know, has some pretty nice features to protect against quantum computing, using only readily available block ciphers, hash functions, and elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. So you can kind of, and when you combine it with just how secure phone calls are made, the fact that it's done through the media channel rather than the signaling, the media channel is harder for Intel agencies to always be able to capture because it's done directly between the two. And as mobile users move around and call each other from different locations, it presents operational difficulties. So it's kind of a good, it's a good improvised solution in the near term. I wasn't going to talk about that much today. It's just that I have this fresh presentation from an hour ago, which was all about how to deal with the post-quantum computing environment. So, but anyway, what I see happening in crypto today is that everybody is upping their game. The fact that the standards bodies, you know, NIST was humiliated by their apparent cooperation with NSA, maybe unwitting cooperation with the use of their random number generator. The IETF, which is an international organization, was already kind of institutionally predisposed to reacting to the Snowden revelations by trying to do something about pervasive surveillance, and we see movement in that direction to create better crypto protocols that are good for that. And the industry as a whole is finding that the customer base is more interested in protecting itself from Intel agencies. And it's not just NSA, it's all Intel agencies. So for those of you who are working in the crypto industry, which is this entire audience, you're facing a future where there's more and more interest in trying to use crypto to protect our traffic. So anyway, I'd like to open it up for questions. By the way, how much time? I haven't been looking at the timer. How much time do we have left for my session? 10 minutes? Okay. So if we could have questions now, that would be good. Yeah. There's microphones. If you run over to that microphone there. And anybody over here who wants to get up to that mic, or this one, go ahead.
So there's often a positioning of a trade-off between usability and security. And that's often a false trade-off. But in your protocol, where if you lose a single session, how would a user recover from a lost phone or some other instance where the actual end user lost the session data?
Well, if you're talking about the ZRTP protocol, you can easily recover that by doing a verbal comparison of the authentication string, the short authentication string, and then you're back, you're good to go again. And if you keep on having a lot of these, you only have to do the verbal comparison once, and it remembers it for next time. But if you keep on doing lots of sessions with your people that you're talking to, every time you do one of those, you're presenting an opportunity for your opponent to miss the interception of that traffic. And if he just misses one of those sessions, he's done. He can't make any further progress in breaking future sessions. So, let's not always see the same hands.
If your session is disrupted, will it automatically rekey the same session, or will it negotiate a new session?
Well, if it's just momentarily losing the media stream, it just comes back up and uses the same key. This happens all the time when you're on the phone and you're in a secure VoIP call. You get in an elevator, the door's closed. Now you're in a Faraday cage. So for 30 seconds, you don't talk. If the other person is patient enough to stay on, then when the elevator door is open, you just start again. If you have to call again, then, well, it's a new session. The more sessions, the better. Each one is a fresh Diffie-Hellman exchange. And if you switch from Wi-Fi to 4G or 4G to Wi-Fi, it presents a different media path, which is, another practical problem for your opponent to solve. He's got to be present in the media path. The ZRTP protocol doesn't use the signaling to negotiate the keys. It uses the media path. And since that doesn't require going through a server most of the time, then there's a good chance your opponent will miss at least one of your sessions. He might get the signaling, but he won't get the media. Yeah.
Earlier you spoke about people's lack of interest and people spying on their email communications. Have you found it to be different for VOIP, that people are more cognizant of the risk for that than they are of email?
Well, I think that people have a different emotional experience, a different psychological experience when they're speaking on the phone. There's a direct human connection. It also kind of connects us with our sort of evolutionary history that, for a million years, for as long as human language has existed, we've had private conversations. Every time you talk to anyone face-to-face, it's a private conversation. And if there's someone standing a few feet away and they can hear you, then you could just walk over there and they can't hear you. So for a million years, for as long as human language, spoken language has existed, we've had the ability to have private conversations, and we've gotten emotionally, we kind of feel that that's the natural way that humans speak. And so when we're talking on the phone, we kind of wish it were like that. But since the invention of the phone and other, the telegraph and, other things maybe a century ago, we've lost the ability to have private conversations. And most of our conversations today are electronic. The bulk of my conversations every day are electronic. And so I'm losing the natural ability that humans have to have private conversations, that our nervous systems and brains and evolved psychology has become used to. And now we find ourselves in a world where we're speaking on a mobile device to someone else, and we have to constantly remind ourselves that whatever I'm saying here might be intercepted by someone else who does not wish me well. We shouldn't trust the phone companies. They don't have your best interest in mind. And that's my protocol that I'm working on these days is specifically designed for not trusting the phone company. We've got to bring back what we enjoyed for centuries, for millennium, that the ability to have the ability to whisper in your ear, even if your ear is 1,000 miles away. And that's what I've been working on for the past decade.
one follow-up. Do you think that over more time, if the interface was easier for users for encrypted emails, as we've made SSL and TLS easier, do you think that there's hope for that?
Yeah, if we could really take the cognitive burden out of it. I mean, what was a difficult problem for PGP and SMIME was that both of them required users to understand something about trust models. And, you know, it's very hard to explain trust models to your mom, you know? I mean, I've spent countless hours on the phone with other cryptographers that are directly working with me on trust models, and sometimes we get tangled up trying to understand the trust model. You know, what about this situation here? You know, we got to figure out what that means for the trust model. It's hard from experienced cryptographers talking to each other. You know, what chance are we going to be able to make something that your mom can understand? And, you know, with secure telephony, it's possible to do this in a way that your mom can make secure calls without thinking about it. So there are some applications of cryptography that don't require understanding trust models. The problem is those systems that require digital signatures and long-term signature keys that have to be maintained, they have to be issued, they have to be revoked, they have to be protected from disclosure for years and years, and you're always worried about whether you got the right one. That's where the complexity comes in, and that's why PGP never became widely used. It became more widely used than any other email encryption, but that's like being the skinniest kid at fat camp, you know? It's just not a big distinction, you know? Nobody uses email encryption. PGP users are, for the most part, people that are very interested in privacy and focus their attention on it. If you've ever seen a PGP key signing party, levels of nerdliness do not exist anywhere on the planet that match the nerdliness at a PGP key signing party. It's been in an XKCD cartoon, you know. if we're going to rely on crypto schemes that are that nerdy, we're never going to make it. But ZRTP doesn't. Your mom can use ZRTP. Yeah.
Yeah, well, another nerdy or geeky question. Do you think that blockchain technology might help either with the problem you mentioned earlier about the fragility of the PKI for TLS servers, certificates, or maybe even with the trust model for person-to-person communication? Blockchain, I mean, you know, Namecoin and all this stuff.
Say that again.
Blockchain is what's used in Bitcoin, but there is also Namecoin that helps you register names and certificates and things like that. I think the W3C is looking into this right now. Do you think that might help?
I haven't really thought too much about blockchains for X509 certificates, but I do think that the certificate transparency seems to hold some promise here. It is possible to come up with ways to counter the problem of people breaking into a certificate authority, stealing the signing key, and issuing certs that are, you know, unethically issued.
Right.
We probably need to do more than that, but that's a good thing that we're starting. I mean, the fact that it's now deployed in Chrome, that's a pretty big deal, you know. So that's. That holds some promise.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Two parts there. Do you think PKI is permanently broken, or do things like DNSSEC and DANE help to seal up some of those holes? And then along the same lines with email encryption, I don't know if you've seen the NCCOE white paper on using DNSSEC and DANE to offer a universal email encryption potential?
Well, I think DNSSEC could be a good thing, but there's also the risk of what happens if the PKI on which DNSSEC relies on is compromised. You know, what happens if the top level signing key is ever compromised? You know, we're going to have to augment that with something like certificate transparency would be one thing, but I don't know. There's still other vulnerabilities.
Yeah, I think that's where sort of DANE falls into place, the DNS-based authentication of named entities, where you store the cert in your DNS entry. Like Google would host a list of their certified certs in their DNS server.
Sure, they could post that. You got to make sure that when you go and fetch it from that post that you're getting the real stuff. You know, here's what I see is happening with the intel agencies, especially NSA, because now we know a lot about that from the Snowden disclosures, is that cryptographers for many years imagine that they win if they can put their opponent in a position to have to solve a hard math problem. So we focus all the time on, oh, let's come up with these elegant mathematical constructions that we imagine that our opponent will have to solve in order to break it. But, you know, the NSA doesn't face those problems as mathematical problems. It tries to turn them into engineering problems. Landing a man on the moon is an engineering problem. It's doable, you know. By breaking into everyone's computers and installing malware and doing zero-day attacks, you know, this is where governments are spending their money on zero days. And that turns it into engineering problems. So us trying harder and harder to try to make better math problems, I'm not sure that's going to get us very far. We work on those because those are fun. It creates the illusion. We develop a kind of smugness that, oh yes, now I've made my opponent have to solve this very hard math problem. But that's not how NSA works, and that's not how the other intel agency work. They turn it into engineering problems.
Okay, thank you. It's more a comment, less than a comment. I try to make a question out of it. It's related to quantum key distribution. I mean, I just want to mention that QKD is a layer zero, so a physical layer technology, which is already very different from the algorithm-based and in this sense less flexible indeed. But it has been implemented over fibers and free space point-to-point, ground-to-satellite, satellite-to-satellite tested. And indeed, it has not been shown for wireless RF communication, as you mentioned, but yeah. It has been used for cell phone or
yes.
Secure cell phone communications based on quantum key distribution. So maybe the question I would ask you is, are you aware of those large QKD networks which are currently built and established
you're
in Asia?
About, you're talking about using quantum key distribution to sort of bootstrap, like load keys into mobile devices.
For example, yes.
Yeah.
My question more is related to those Asian quantum networks, like especially in China, there is a quantum key distribution network much larger than the original DARPA network was already today. Do you think this is a future or just a big scientific experiment, as you phrased it?
Well, I think it has its place. If you have fixed infrastructure in place where you've got dedicated glass fibers running between them, and it's, you know, there's nothing dynamic about it. It's not like carrying a mobile phone around and calling somebody that I've never met before. I can't do that with quantum key distribution.
Oh, yes.
What we can do is we can bootstrap certain things so that certain relationships are reinforced by quantum key distribution. But that involves some procedural things. As you said, it's down at the physical layer. Well, in fact, the word physical layer really becomes very heightened when you're talking about, you know, photon polarization and stuff like that. That's very, very physical.
But in the same sense, in the infrastructure we have today, if you rip away the physical channel or the fiber channels, then nothing would work anyway. So this is a part of the...
Well, actually, no, I, from my point of view, I'm up at the application layer and maybe just below that. And when you rip away the bottom stuff and replace it with something else, I can't even tell the difference. Mm-hmm. I can't tell the difference between Wi-Fi and 3G for my protocol. I just need an IP stack. Give me an IP stack of any kind, and I can negotiate what I need to through it. And if that's glass fiber, great. If it's copper or 3G or 4G or LTE, I'm interested in mobile computing. And I think more and more of human society is that their daily experience with computing is going to be with mobile devices. And while it is possible to do quantum key distribution in certain areas and then transfer keys into mobile devices and then use that to bootstrap the process, it doesn't have the kind of spontaneity that allows you to call people that you've never met before. I mean, at some point, you know, then you get into kind of, what are you going to do, Kerberos or something like that, where you're trying to, where you have to trust, you know, servers. Then you're right back where you started. I think that the quantum key distribution has its place in certain dedicated data center to data center connections. But applications generally don't have access to knowledge of what's happening at the physical layer. We went through the trouble of building these layered protocols, and we like them to be in layers. It's good to have them in layers. It means you can swap out layers and without disturbing the other layers. But that means that you can't tell at the application layer that the keys that were at the physical layer were properly done, you know? And did it really go end-to-end? And what does end-to-end mean when it's, you know, between those boxes? You have these mobile devices and you want to go end-to-end with that. The application layer has to know what that is. And generally speaking, the application layer doesn't know what IPsec is doing. It doesn't know what how the keys were negotiated down at the bottom. I mean, yeah, you could maybe try to put something in the GUI that tells you, you know, I use TunnelBlick, for example. You know, TunnelBlick will tell me whether my VPN connection is working. But the applications I'm running on my laptop, they don't know anything about TunnelBlick. They don't know whether it's safe to proceed with an encrypted channel or not. And also, with my VPN, it's really just going between me and a VPN server. What I'm looking for is, I want any human to talk to any other human at any time while they're walking around in the real world with devices in their pocket. And I don't think I can get there with quantum key distribution. It has its place, and it's great that it has its place. But you know, for connecting strategic infrastructure together, it's nice to have. But I don't want to rely just on that. There's got to be other protocols involved that can work on different physical layers.
Good, thank you.
I think I'm probably out of time. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.